You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of December 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio 2 here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, can the US really be friends with the Republic of China and the People's Republic of China? My guests John Everard and Jacob Parakilis will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including Iran Air's massive order from Boeing. Is it too big a deal for Trump to jeopardize? Will Nicolas Maduro's currency reform rescue Venezuela's economy? Clue? No. And has the US Congress accidentally given Donald Trump his own propaganda network? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to the show. My guests today are John Everard, former UK ambassador to North Korea, Belarus, and Uruguay, and Jacob Parakilis, assistant head of the US and the Americas program at Chatham House. Welcome both. We will start tonight with the future or otherwise of one of the world's more transparent diplomatic hypocrisies. This is the United States' so-called One China policy, under which Washington does not formally recognize Taiwan as a sovereign state, but treats it as such in pretty much every respect that matters, trading with it, arming it, and so forth. This fiction is maintained in order to placate Beijing, which still regards Taiwan as a temporarily runaway province. The arrangement, like so much else, may shortly be upended by President Donald Trump. Jacob, first of all, Trump told Fox at the weekend that he didn't know why we have to be bound by a One China policy unless we make a deal with China having to do with other things, including trade. Do we yet understand what relationship Donald Trump thinks he wants with China?
Not exactly. Excuse me, please. I think what Trump has outlined, what his overall strategic perspective is that the People's Republic of China is the great strategic threat to the U.S. And it's not clear whether he thinks that he can sort of find a new means of containing China the way that previous American presidents do. He certainly doesn't have the same sense that the network of U.S. alliances in Asia, which has been the cornerstone one way or the other of American administrations going back 40 or 50 years, is the way to do it, or if he thinks that he can just sort of forge a new relationship. The story behind his call with Taiwan is still a little bit unclear. It seems that Bob Dole, the former Republican senator and presidential candidate, who's also a paid lobbyist for Taiwan, had some hand in organizing it. But it seems that the sort of the China Hawk caucus within the Republican Party, which is a, you know, it's not a small minority, but the more aggressive side of it is a fairly small minority. And they seem to have gotten through to Trump on this one.
John, we often ask you on these programs to serve as an interpreter of diplomatic language in which he once professionally traded into the common vernacular. When China says it is, and I quote, seriously concerned, what does that translate as approximately?
It means something like one more false step and we shoot. China being really quite annoyed. It's in Chinese terms, it's quite strong language. Can I just pick up on a point that Jacob was making, who is formulating this policy? Bob Dole absolutely had a hand in there. I think, actually, and rather reassuringly, the big architect of what is going on is not Donald Trump, who, as we have observed, does have a tendency to shoot from the lip. It is Ed Foellner. And Ed Foellner used to be the head of the Heritage Foundation until 2013, I think, an extremely intelligent, very conservative man, not given to improvising and not given to making idiotic mistakes. But he is also the man who crafted Ronald Reagan's six assurances to Taiwan in 1982. You remember when Ronald Reagan came to power, everybody thought he'd rip up Jimmy Carter's new China policy. He didn't. He modified it. And that was Ed Foellner's doing. And I'm indulging the hope that what is going on is not simply a bull in a China shop, but quite
So to speak, yes.
Yeah. but a quite carefully crafted policy with which I might not agree, but which is at least being put forward by somebody whose intellectual credentials are impeccable.
Jacob, this is what I've been, like the rest of the planet, trying to figure out, to what sense there is any coherent strategy at large here and to what extent this is just Donald Trump acting on the brainstorm of the moment. You mentioned the phone call he had with Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen. One of the many things it made me think was that, well, Isn't that the sort of thing that a president of the United States should be doing, i.e. interacting with the elected president of a functional free democracy in defiance of the wishes of a fairly obnoxious tyranny?
I think the way to think about this is that, you know, you can think in terms of, yes, the United States should be able to have straightforward diplomatic relations with other countries, particularly other countries with democratically elected leaderships. The objection, as I understand it, from a lot of Asia watchers to this wasn't that the president-elect of the United States decided that he would be changing the longstanding U.S. policy towards China and Taiwan. It was that he did it in sort of seemingly haphazard fashion, and that when questioned about it, his response was, well, why shouldn't I be allowed to accept a congratulatory phone call? It wasn't framed in terms of, here's a policy shift, we've thought about this seriously, and we're going to... we're putting China on notice with it. It was, well, it was a congratulatory phone call, and I people are congratulating me, and I should be able to accept that. I'm sure there's more to it, more behind it than that. But when you're playing with something as complicated and as fraught as the U.S.-China relationship, you want to see that every single aspect of it has been gamed out and carefully thought through. Not that it's not his prerogative to change the policy, but that you want to see him change it in a way that, you know, makes sense.
Of course, it may be that that is precisely what has happened, and that those advising Trump have gone for deliberate uncertainty, getting Trump to make statements on the one hand, accepting Taiwan's call, and then a few days later appointing an old friend of China as the new ambassador to China, and then, of course, we have the later set of statements, so as to throw the Chinese off balance. I think there's a sense in the Republican Party that for too long China has called the shots. China has been the one that the United States has always had to second guess. Now, with Trump, for better or worse, the boot's on the other foot.
Well, you say better or for worse there, John, and just a final thought on this. To what extent will nerves be jangling in Taipei? Because if you want to sort of game through worst-case scenarios, if China worries that the US might be about to pivot in a fairly dramatic fashion towards Taiwan, and China then further calculates on top of that that, frankly, somebody with the isolationist instincts of Donald Trump is not going to risk World War III to save Taiwan, is there any chance that a slightly perhaps more aggressive Chinese regime 2-3 years down the line might think, well, it's now or never?
2-3 years down the line, in Trump terms, must seem an eternity. China is not militarily in a position to attack Taiwan, even without US reinforcements, just at the moment. The Taiwanese have very good defensive, and China does not have major amphibious capability. So I think the Taiwanese can probably sleep safe in their bed for the time being. And certainly in the Taiwanese media, there's no real sign of anxiety yet.
Okay, well, let's move along, and we'll look at a story which brings conveniently together two other entities who will presently be puzzling extra hard vis-a-vis what a Donald Trump presidency might mean for them. One is Boeing, to whom Trump has already signaled that he may cancel a mooted order for the next generation of 747s, which would serve as Air Force One. The other is Iran, whose deal with the rest of the world over its nuclear program may also be in jeopardy. Nevertheless, Iran Air has announced a deal to buy 80. That's 80 new aeroplanes from Boeing. Jacob, that's $16.6 billion worth. This is a huge order for Boeing, and it's a huge amount of money for Iran. Is this an indication that Iran, at least for the moment, is confident that it is returning to the world, that it is being brought in from the cold, as it were?
It's an indication of that, but it's also the fact that they announced it in this short interregnum between the election and the inauguration of the new president, rather than sometime in January, February, when it could be sort of, you know, done in more leisurely fashion, is also them trying to lock in the deal with some kind of commercial relationship. I mean, as we know, one of Trump's greatest priorities is keeping American jobs in America. And, you know, there are very few more American companies, companies that have more sort of American workers building identifiably American products than Boeing.
And there are tens of thousands of jobs riding on this deal alone.
Well, it'll help keep the 777 production line going. And the 777 is a very big aircraft. It's very expensive. It takes lots of man hours to build. And that is, you know, maintaining that and maintaining factories to build it is a quiver in Boeing's arrow against Trump.
John, I had the pleasure, it was a pleasure actually, of flying Iran Air a few years ago, back in quite early on in the history of Monocle magazine. I was sent to fly its recently unveiled route between Tehran and Caracas. And it was interesting because talking to the air crew who had been with Iran Air for many, many decades, before going back before the Islamic Revolution, and they spoke of a time where, as the captain said, we were the Emirates of our days. We were one of the world's great, great airlines. We flew all over the world in considerable style. Is it imaginable that that could happen again? And is that indeed what we think Iran wants? That again, that it looks upon what the Gulf carriers have done for the likes of Abu Dhabi, Dubai and Qatar?
Yes, I think that's very likely. I mean, Iran has understandably not made any kind of statement about its long-term aims or exactly why it wanted so many aircraft. But effectively, Iran is completely re-equipping its fleet. 80 aircraft, as you pointed at the beginning, is a lot of aircraft, including, notice, the 737 MAX, one of the newest aircraft around. I think its maiden flight was only in January this year. So real state-of-the-art stuff. And Iran has, in general terms, long made clear its wish to reassume the role it lost before the Islamic Revolution, although of course it doesn't put it in quite those terms, but to be the major power in the region and to reassume, as it sees it, its regional primacy.
Jacob, what do you think? As an exercise in nation branding, how important is this for Iran that it is able to put in the sky this sort of beautiful new fleet of what I'm sure will be very handsomely appointed aircraft?
It's very important. I mean, you've seen in the case of Turkey, for example, if you want to fly to huge numbers of destinations from Europe to Africa to the Middle East, you know, Turkish Airlines is one of the in some cases, the only way to get there. In other cases, the only direct way to get there. And it has the name of the country, and they've put a lot of effort into having a new fleet with good service. And that's a massive example of sort of getting people to come through your country on connecting flights, of having your flag and your name.
For which Tehran would be perfectly situated.
For which Tehran would be, you know, travel sanctions against Americans notwithstanding, geographically, Tehran's in a great location between Europe and the Middle East and Africa and Asia. You know, it's very central. But it will be a huge boost to Iran's sort of, not soft power exactly, but national branding. I think that's a pretty good way to describe it.
John, does it tell us something that Iran Air has chosen to buy from Boeing rather than Airbus? Is this Iran again trying to make the links between it and the United States that exist now slightly less breakable?
That's the kind of question we'll probably never get a pretty clear answer to. I mean, it may be that there was a heavy political component to this decision, or it may be simply that Boeing offered a better deal. And I don't suppose that the figures are ever going to come into the public domain. Could I just come back on a point you raised earlier? Trump's reaction to all this. Trump, as you rightly said, fiercely opposed the Iran nuclear deal. The proponents of that deal must be laughing all over their faces right now. Here's Trump saying this is a bad deal, and Trump at the same time saying American jobs for American workers. 100,000 jobs riding on this deal. It's a huge number. How can Trump possibly now continue to criticize it?
Well, on that score, Jacob, is there any doubt that this will go ahead? Because the House of Representatives has passed a bill which, if I've read it right, would effectively prevent the sale of commercial airliners to Iran. It would stop the Treasury issuing licenses to banks which they need to finance the deals. But given those stakes, as John mentions, 100,000 jobs at least, $16.6 billion, would any American politician, whatever their animus against Iran, dare screw this up?
Well, I think Trump actually is in a slightly different category. I mean, during the, you know, John's right that he fiercely opposed the deal, but he opposed it on different grounds. And, you know, people like Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio opposed it on entirely ideological grounds. Iran is an enemy of the United States, they said. They have opposed Israel. We should stand up to them. We shouldn't have any kind of interaction with them until they start behaving better. And Trump's opposition was a little bit more muddled, but he did come out and say, this is a bad deal and we're not even getting anything out of it. We're not getting any commercial opportunities out of it. So his, you know, in the inimitable way in which Trump is a deal maker before anything else, he looked at the deal and he said, okay, well, what's the commercial element to this? So I suspect, and given the fact that a lot of the previous opponents of the deal, well, they're still opponents of the deal, but people like James Mattis, who will be Trump's defense secretary, are now saying, we can't back out of the deal now. It will just put us in a worse position. The Europeans won't go back in. The Russians and the Chinese won't go back in on the sanctions. So we'll be basically just losing out on commercial opportunities while Iran laughs at us. So my guess is, for all the rhetoric, Trump will make a big deal out of sort of looking to find ways to enforce the deal or maybe passing some other sanctions, but that the nuclear deal will remain in place for the near term, and I suspect this Boeing deal will as well.
John, furthering that thought about Trump as the mercantilist, the pragmatist, rather than the ideologue, who probably doesn't have any fixed opinions about Iran and indeed may not even be able to point to it on a map, is it arguable, and I'm trying one of my irregular attempts at optimism about all this here, is it possible that a figure such as him might actually be more likely to engineer a rapprochement with a country like Iran than a figure like Hillary Clinton, who it was always fairly hawkish on the foreign policy front, who clearly does have not quite as virulent an ideological animus towards Iran as some of those other people Jacob mentioned, but nonetheless. Is it altogether unimaginable that at some point in the next 4 years, you know, Air Force One touches down at Imam Khomeini Airport and Donald Trump steps out of the door waving?
It's a possibility. I mean, yes, I'm all for optimistic analyses of that kind. And Donald Trump certainly carries a lot less ideological baggage than Hillary Clinton or than most of the US presidents who preceded him. This kind of pragmatism may just make a deeper rapprochement possible. Let's watch.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, John Everard, and Jacob Parakilis. Coming up next, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro tries his hand at currency reform. What could possibly go wrong?
Okay, so 2016 wasn't the greatest of years. But don't worry, there are plenty of reasons why 2017 will be better. And we've packed lots of them into more than 250 pages of the new edition of the Monocle Forecast. It's the magazine for those who want to look over the horizon and spot the new opportunities the new year will bring. From the rising global powers to keep an eye on, to the startups to invest in, and the cities you'll want to call home. It's packed with opinion and wit, with ideas and provocations, and guaranteed to keep you talking all the way through 2017. The Monocle Forecast. Buy your copy today and know what's happening tomorrow.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are John Everard and Jacob Parakilis. Now, Venezuelan listeners with significant quantities of 100 Bolivar notes stashed in their mattresses have until Christmas to trade them in for coins or a new range of higher denomination bills. This will be no small undertaking. There are more than 6 billion 100 Bolivar notes in circulation. That's roughly half of Venezuelans' paper currency. It is the latest bright idea of beleaguered President Nicolas Maduro, who claims that the measure will thwart mafia gangs who have been buying the rapidly depreciating currency by the pallet on the black market and stockpiling it. John, the 100 Bolivar note is practically worthless. It's worth about 2 cents even on the black market. I think I've done these sums right. Maduro says the gangs hold 300 billion bolivars in 100 Bolivar notes held overseas. He's trying to sort of stop them, re-import them, etc., etc. I think I've done the maths right. That's only $60 million.
Yes, you're right. I ran the same sums and came up with the same figures.
Which, so in the terms of a national economy, is beans.
Well, yes, that's right. I mean, he's chasing effectively peanuts. And one wonders why there's all this fuss and all this inconvenience foisted on innocent Venezuelans. To add insult to injury, he's not only announced the demonetization of the 100 Bolivar note, but the launch of a smart new range of new banknotes, starting with 500 bolivars and going up to 20,000. If 100 bolivars is worth 2 cents, then listeners who are quick at arithmetic will work out that a 500 bolivars is worth a massive 10 cents, and even the big 20,000 bolivar note is worth only $4. These notes are dead before they even enter circulation. Remember, this is a country where to buy a beef burger, you need a stash of notes about as thick as a brick, and a bit more inflation. We're going to have exactly the same with the new notes too.
Jacob, is that what we're looking at here in Venezuela, a currency in an actual death spiral? It's a very strange thing to witness up close, and I've been in a couple of places at a couple of times. I remember Afghanistan under the Taliban, Iraq under Saddam Hussein, just like literally walking around Kabul and Baghdad with a knapsack full of money, about half of which you needed to buy lunch. And it does have a very practically and I think quite psychologically debilitating effect on the people.
It does. And the, I mean, the bigger problem is basically that Venezuela is a very oil-driven economy, and the price of oil has stayed stubbornly low. They're dependent on U.S. refineries to refine their oil. The U.S. isn't doing them any favors. The market isn't doing them any favors. So in a way, you know, this is all kind of just scribbling on the side of, you know, a sinking ship. I mean, this is until oil prices massively increase, the currency issues are not the fundamental problem, and there's only so much the government can do to sort of stabilize the currency in the face of that.
I mean, John, it's always interesting is one word of one way of putting it. We'll call it an interesting question where President Maduro is concerned. Why is he doing this?
Perhaps he does genuinely believe that there's a much bigger problem in black money than the numbers we've just been running suggests. Perhaps he just wants to show that he's doing something about the currency, about the hyperinflation that has made so many Venezuelan lives a misery. Perhaps he's just leaping around trying to look active as president. Of course, he's been accused by the opposition of being inactive in the face of disaster. Who knows?
Jacob, he is, of course, reiterating his now familiar line that none of this is, obviously, none of it's his fault, and certainly none of it is the fault of his predecessor, El Comandante Chavez. It is all about an economic war being waged by the inevitable imperial forces trying to bring him down. Is there, and this may be a self-answering question, but is there any actual evidence to support that theory?
No, I don't think the U.S. I mean, as I said, the U.S. hasn't done Venezuela any favors, but it doesn't owe Venezuela any favors, and B, you know, the fundamentals, the reasons why Venezuela is in this state don't really have much of anything to do with the U.S. It's about mismanagement of the oil. It's about corruption in public services. It's about sort of, you know, big structural factors that Maduro and Chavez in some cases tried to fix and weren't capable of, in some cases exacerbated. I mean, there's just no real evidence of a sort of imperialist plot to destabilize Venezuela's currency.
I mean, John, is there somewhere at the heart of this even the basis of a good idea? I mean, we've seen obviously Narendra Modi in India do something broadly similar in recent weeks, abolishing the 500 and 1,000 rupee notes, which appears not to have proceeded entirely seamlessly as a bureaucratic exercise. Incredible in India, I know, but is there the germ of an idea in there that if you hoover up these small denominations, which are the standard currency of bribery in developing countries, that it does remove an amount of black money from the market?
It is possible to achieve that aim by doing it, but you have to be very, very careful. The big problem, as we're seeing in both the Venezuelan and the Indian cases, is massive collateral damage. We're just talking about Venezuela. In India, slightly cag-handedly, of course, Narendra Modi introduced this measure on 8 November, just when everybody was watching the United States rather than India, but which happens to be just before prime Indian wedding season. And of course, villages across India have been sitting on piles of cash ready to pay for all the ceremonies, the sweets, everything, only discover just as their sons and daughters are about to get married that all the money's worthless. It wasn't a smart move.
Timing is everything. Finally tonight, back when it was widely assumed that Donald Trump would never be elected president, it was also widely assumed that his run was a publicity stunt for a future television network of his own, nigh certainly to be called Trump TV. It now looks like he, and by extension we, might end up with something of the sort anyway. An obscure provision of a Defense Act passed by Congress just last week disbands the bipartisan board, which oversees Voice of America and Radio Free Europe, among others, in favour of a CEO appointed by guess who? Those two outlets, Jacob, fall under the purview of the Broadcasting Board of Governors. They reach 100 countries, 278 million listeners, 61 languages. How important is it, and more to the point, how important is it that it seemed to be at least as impartial as a state-sponsored news network can reasonably be?
So the Voice of America isn't as important as it was in the sort of height of the Cold War. After the end of the Cold War, it diminished. The U.S. took away funding for a number of languages, a number of broadcasts. It kind of stripped it down. It began to recapitalize it slightly with an added focus on the Arab world after 9/11, but it still hasn't sort of reached the peak that it was in the, you know, the 50s, 60s, 70s, when it had a very obvious target, which was people living in the Soviet Union and in Soviet allied countries. And part of that is just that the information ecology now is completely different. It's much more complex, and that audiences are generally more cynical about government-backed media. But it's something where the U.S., and we've done some research on this, and, you know, there's clearly a market that the U.S. could reach. There's opposition that or presenting a counterbalance that the U.S. could do to, for example, RT and Russian-backed efforts, which have been very well-funded and very aggressive. And the U.S. has been beginning to do that. I don't know the extent to which the Broadcasting Board of Governors was the obstacle. I think this is partly a desire to put the Voice of America more directly under the control of the president, which has been a Republican goal for a while.
John, you would have seen this up close, having, you know, worked in North Korea, but how potentially important, especially in a closed society like that, is a network like the Voice of America or the World Service, or at least some voice from the outside world reminding people that there is another reality?
It's very important if people trust it. And I think this goes to the heart of what is going on in these changes. Firstly, I mean, this is not just about putting Trump's man at the top of, not just Voice of America, but the whole caboodle. This is the board that also runs Radio Free Asia and all the various other offshoots. It's also about fixing the structure, which is badly broken, as everybody has admitted, for some time now. The existing board is part-time, hasn't always got to grips with some very difficult issues, and the whole organisation has been allowed to drift. Now, nevertheless, the recent CEO has managed to breathe life into the various broadcasting services to the extent that audience figures have risen by about 50 million over the last few years. If Trump does screw this up, put somebody in who's simply a Trumpkin, who has no real understanding of broadcasting, those figures will go down again because people will not regard this as a credible source of information. People in North Korea, people in close societies, may not have access to good information, but they are not stupid, and they can usually tell a fake quite early on.
Jacob, it was easy to tell when he was running for president what the potential appeal of a Trump network might be to Donald Trump. And again, I'm asking, you know, somebody to explain to me what Donald Trump is thinking, for which apologies in advance. But what does he need it for now? I mean, when you're the president of the United States, you can walk onto any program on any TV network anywhere in the world anytime you feel like. You can have as much airtime as you can be bothered to fill.
Well, it's not clear how much he does need it. I mean, the story is apparently that the Clinton campaign set up a meeting with the Broadcasting Board of Governors to discuss the changes and, of course, canceled it after the election because there was no longer really a Clinton campaign, and the Trump campaign didn't. So I don't get the sense that the Trump campaign feels as though they have a pressing need, and I'm sure they'll find a way to use this, but they also have they have a close alignment with Fox News. They have a close alignment with Breitbart. I mean, Breitbart's CEO is now the chief strategist in the White House. So they have these hugely powerful information arms, which are in a way better than official because they're ideologically aligned but unofficial. And that gives them a certain degree of credulity and credibility, especially if they occasionally challenge the White House because that sets them apart a little bit. I think in a way those will be more effective carriers of his message than any official government, no matter how propagandized and how sort of Trumpy it becomes. I think he will still prefer to use the unofficial organs.
Let's be clear that, you know, the disaster has not yet struck. It may be that we are actually getting overexcited about this. It may be that Trump decides this is not worth the candle and simply puts in a qualified media professional to run the place who does so in a good way. You know, it may be that this is simply an attempt to fix a broken board.
Let's hope so. John Everard and Jacob Parakilis, thank you both very much for joining us here at Midori House. That is all we have time for on today's episode. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alexis Sogol. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. There's more music next at 1900. It's Culture with Robert Bound, and more on the day's main stories on the Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening and goodbye.